Well, we've been trying to understand a little bit about baptism. I think it's important to know that if you follow the literature, and I am a member of a number of groups that are religious groups, and they're not composed entirely of people associated with the Church of Christ. In fact, some of them are mostly composed of people from outside groups. And on these groups, I've been noticing in the last 10 years that more and more people are starting to talk about baptism as being an integral part of the salvation that they're looking for. People have always thought that it played a part, but many groups felt like baptism was really best described as an outward sign of an inward grace, that you were saved and then you were baptized as a means of demonstrating to the world your commitment to God. And so it wasn't something that you would, of course, do immediately upon realizing that you believed in God. That's kind of the approach that we've taken. But they would do it, they would kind of stack baptisms up, and once every 6 months or something like that, they would have a baptizing period or a baptizing meeting. But that is beginning to, I think it's beginning to change. I can't say for certain. I can't say that there are groups that are coming to an understanding of baptism, but more and more people are talking about it. That's for sure. So it's important for us to know how to talk about baptism, to know whether or not this was something that happened in the first century. So we're gonna spend some time talking about baptism. Now, last week we talked about baptism as it existed before the time of Jesus in the Qumran community. The Qumran community was to the west of Jerusalem. It was people, basically Essenes, who distanced themselves from anything that had to do with the cities, and that meant that they distanced themselves from Jerusalem as well. They tended to be very, very sincere in their religious beliefs. We don't read very much about them in the New Testament, with a couple of examples or mentions that are thrown in. And it's largely because they had a very limited impact on the culture at the time that Jesus was living. Most of the impact was from the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So we're gonna talk about baptism tonight, not among the Essenic or Essene community. And some people would even go so far as to argue that's the community that John the Baptist would have been associated with. We've kind of established that baptism or ritual purifications, ritual washings, played an important role in the Qumran community. Tonight we're going to talk about baptism among the people who lived in Jerusalem. And all of this, of course, is leading up to what the Apostle Peter had to say on Pentecost: repent and be baptized, every one of you. He didn't have to stop and define that term, baptized. When Peter said, repent and be baptized, it immediately struck a chord with the people that heard it, largely because they were familiar with the idea of ritual washing. Now, we will continue to talk about it, and we'll see how it differs from the ritual washings that they were familiar with. But it is important to understand that the Qumran community and the community in Jerusalem had an extensive experience with baptism. This, I've termed this the Second Temple period. Of course, everybody understands that this is the time when the temple has been rebuilt. It was extensively modified beginning in 200 BC, and it was finally destroyed for the last time in 70 AD. You do understand that there were multiple buildings that were built that were called the temple. But generally speaking, when we talk about the Second Temple period, it's the period when the Second Temple was standing and it was in its heyday. This is the period from about 200 BC to 70 AD. It's the period when Jesus actually walked on the earth. And we've mentioned how the Jews often purified themselves. There were several activities that demanded purification among the Qumran community, but let's talk about it in terms of the Jewish community that lived in Jerusalem. You've read the Old Testament, of course. And you know that there were some activities that meant that you were unclean. If you had a disease that looked like leprosy, then you could present yourself to the priest. He would examine it. If it was found not to be leprosy, then he would pronounce you as not unclean. If it was leprosy, you were unclean, but there are different kinds of leprosy and some could be healed. So if you'd had leprosy and then it healed by itself, you were unclean and you had to wash before you could attend to the temple. There were certain times when, a woman's menstrual cycle that she became unclean. It was ceremonially unclean. And so when that period of the menstrual cycle was finished, the woman had to wash. She had to go through a ritual purification before she could enter the temple. Well, Josephus, who lived at this time and writes about everything that was going on from the perspective of a Jew. Of course, you remember that Josephus was taken captive by the Romans. And so in order to ingratiate himself to the Romans, he writes about the history of the Jews. Now, that, of course, means that that's going to be a little bit twisted. But he's a pretty good source for understanding what was happening with the Jews. If you're just really interested in this period of time, Alfred Edersheim wrote a couple of books that are outstanding. One is The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. It's a book that's about 3 inches thick, and it has tiny, tiny print in it. If you're interested in taking up a reading effort that will last 3 or 4 years, get a hold of this book and read this book. It's fascinating to see the background of the Pharisees and the background of the Sadducees, and you'll learn about things that you never really wanted to learn about. But if you want a good understanding of the culture when Jesus walked the earth, this is an outstanding book. It's Alfred Edersheim, Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. He wrote another book called The Temple and Its Practices. That one is not nearly as exhaustive as The Life and Times is, but both of those books are very good. They're both very interesting reading. And the best place to get those is on the used book market. Don't go out and buy a new one. Buy a used one. People buy these things as textbooks and then they tend to sell them. So it's a good way to get a hold of copies of those books. Mark, the seventh chapter and verse 4. There are a couple of really interesting things that I didn't realize about the Jewish purification rituals until I was reading in the English Standard Translation. Mark, the seventh chapter, verse 4, this is from the English Standard, says, when they come from the marketplace, that would be a Jew who's gone out to the marketplace. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. There are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels, that I knew, and dining couches. I didn't realize that they actually had provisions for washing big pieces of furniture, beds that they laid on. If, for instance, you died in the bed became unclean. And whoever tried to rouse you in the morning, had no idea that you had died overnight, took you to wake you up in the morning. That person became unclean. So the person had to wash. I knew that they washed cups and bowls and those kinds of things. I didn't realize they even washed furniture. So when we talk about the practice of baptism, understand how many things had to be cleansed. Look at Luke, the 11th chapter. And in verse 38 of Luke 11, it says, the Pharisees were astonished when they saw that Jesus and his disciples did not first wash their hands or their bodies before dinner. Now, this was a common practice. The Pharisees kind of turned it into a ritualized thing, but this practice of washing before dinner, that which is, you're not even going to the temple. It's not something that we think of as being overtly religious. The Jews still practiced washing, and it wasn't washing necessarily in order to get your hands clean. You know, I wash my hands before I eat dinner, and I do it just for hygiene purposes because I don't know what I've been touching. They did it. Of course, it had a hygienic effect, but they didn't necessarily do it for hygiene. They did it because of ritual uncleanness. They did not want to eat with unwashed hands. Give you an idea of how strict the Pharisees were about this kind of thing. If they were drinking from a cup and a fly touched the cup, the cup became unclean and they could not drink what was in the cup. So in order to keep that from happening, they would take a kerchief, a handkerchief, and place it over the cup so that it draped all the way down to the table to prevent a fly who had touched something unclean, who had landed on something unclean, then flying over and landing on their cup and making the cup unclean. So this was a big deal. Epiphanius, I probably butchered that name. He's a 4th century Christian writer. He identified a 1st century group among the Jews that he called them Hemerobaptists. And they believed, according to Epiphanius, that daily baptisms were required. Daily washing was required for moral purity. That doesn't surprise me, because the Jews took what was a good thing and they tended to expand it to make it something that seems almost silly. Remember, you had the group they called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. Well, they didn't ever want to see something sinful. So whenever they went out of their house, they closed their eyes. And they called them the bruised and bleeding Pharisees because they were always falling down stairs and they were running into walls. You know, I understand not exposing myself unnecessarily to things that are unclean, that I shouldn't be exposing myself to, but it gets silly when you get to the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. Now, these Hermiobaptists may be the forerunners of those who contend that one baptism is not enough, that you need to be baptized over and over again. Anytime you have let God down, and after baptism you have again returned to sin, they would say you need to be baptized again. I don't know if that's the case, but we'll be talking about that kind of philosophy a little bit later. Any questions up to this point or comments?
I appreciate your observation that when Peter was preaching, he didn't stop to explain baptism. It was just, he just put it out there and it was understood by his hearers. And I never really thought about that before.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, all these many generations later, I have the whole scripture. And so I have a concept of what baptism is because I've studied that. But those people hearing him, it never occurred to me before that if it was something new, there would be some confusion and he would have to explain it.
Right.
But they had a knowledge of what baptism meant. And I find that interesting. That never occurred to me before.
Right. I think that's an interesting or an important point to remember. We tend to think of someone who had known only John's baptism as being ignorant or somehow less well skilled in understanding Christianity than we ourselves are. And you have to remember, they had a long background with baptism. So that would not have been surprising. Now, you know, it's interesting to say, well, the Jews had these rules about washing and we know what that was. The best way to understand the practice is to perhaps look at how they carried it out. And it's been said that, you know, if you go to Jerusalem and you drop a penny on the ground, and you were to dig a hole right there, you would find something from antiquity. That city has been occupied continuously for so long. It's kind of like other cities that are of such great age. Like, well, we think of some place like Rome. The area in and around Jerusalem is like that. In the course of researching this material, I read about a family that owned a house in Jerusalem, in the old part of Jerusalem, and they wanted to redo the floors. So this is a very old house. They tore up the floor so they could redo the floor. And lo and behold, underneath of the floor, they found one of these mikvahs that we're going to talk about that dated from the time of Jesus. That meant that they couldn't fix their floor. Now they have a hole in the middle of their living room floor and it can't be fixed because they uncovered something of archaeological significance. I'm glad I don't live in Jerusalem if that's the way things go there. But these baptismal fonts, they called them mikvahs. We talked about it a little bit last week among the Qumran community. They have found these mikvahs all over Jerusalem, according to the archaeologists. In fact, they say that most of the wealthy families that lived in what was called the upper city. Remember, the city of Jerusalem is built on a hill. So you had the city, then you came up to the Temple Mount. That was the first level. And then you went up from there to David's throne or David's fortress. That was on the highest part of Jerusalem. So this upper city is the area concentrated wealth that was between the level of the temple and David's fortress. And most of the private residences in the upper city, in the old upper city, had their own private mikvahs. You know, you didn't want to go to a public mikvah. You wanted to have something that was well maintained and it was very clean. And so they would have their own private mikvahs. In fact, in the area around the Temple Mount, archaeologists in 1987, think about how long ago that was, archaeologists in 1987 have been able to locate 48 mikvahs that are right in the area around the Temple Mount. And that's from Biblical Archaeology Review back in 1987. Fascinating to read this kind of stuff. Just remember, Biblical Archaeology Review is from a background that kind of plays fast and loose with the concept of Christianity. By 1993, they wrote that they had found 150 of these mikvahs, these baptismal pools, around Jerusalem or in within the city walls of the old city of Jerusalem. And that was 1993. I was watching one video that was done by an archaeologist, and his conclusion was that Herod tried to turn the Pool of Siloam, which you read about in the New Testament, into a giant public mikvah. And there's some question about whether that was the case or not, but they've done some digs around the Pool of Siloam, and they find these stairs that go down into what they think was the pool. The archaeology is a little bit limited around that Pool of Siloam, mostly because the Greek Orthodox Church owns part of the land that would have included the big part of the pool in the Pool of Siloam. So they haven't been able to do a lot of archaeology there. You know, it's same way with the Dome of the Rock. The mosque, the Dome of the Rock, is located on the, for everything we know, the best location of where the actual temple stood. Well, there's no chance that you're going to be able to bring down the Dome of the Rock and do archaeological exploration there, even though that would be such a great place to do the exploration. We have limited information, but even from what we understand, they found 150 of these mikvahs around Jerusalem. That was in 1993. Somebody had a comment. I didn't mean to talk over you.
I had a question a while ago. I don't know if you're talking about recently or not, but is this also the points you've made? Kind of, there's a lot of Christians who think that when he said be baptized in the name of the Lord, that he meant just immerse yourself in the Christian lifestyle. And maybe they, I don't know, I think I've heard them, a lot of people refer to it doesn't mean actually like being baptized. It just means immerse yourself in godly things.
Yeah, that's the kind of talk that's being called into question in a lot of what I'm reading. People are saying, no, baptism really was immersing yourself in water.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Now, why do I spend so much time talking about the number of mikvahs that they found in Jerusalem? Around the 1900s, there were a lot of people who argued that you couldn't have been talking about water baptism because there wasn't that much water in Jerusalem where you could have baptized water baptism 3,000 people in one day. And that seemed persuasive to a lot of people. Most of us had never been to Jerusalem. When they tell me something about Jerusalem, I pretty much have to take it at face value because I've never been there. I don't know how to question that kind of thing. And Jerusalem impresses me as being a desert town. Now it's in the mountains, but it doesn't seem like a place where you would have a lot of naturally available pools of water to baptize 3,000 souls on one day. And we know that that's what happened in Acts 2 at verse 41. The record says on that day, first Pentecost, on that day, there were baptized 3,000 souls. And that does take a good bit of water. But remember, if you have 50 private mikvahs and you have 150 public mikvahs, there's nothing surprising at all about being able to baptize 3,000 people in one day. Even if you just figured, okay, they used 30 mikvahs. They used 30 pools that were available. Many of them were public. They used 30 pools. That meant they baptized 100 people in each pool. That doesn't prove the gospel account. It doesn't prove what we've been saying about Acts 2, but it certainly does make Acts 2 a very realistic kind of description of what was going on when Peter preached about baptism.
Dean?
Yeah.
It seems to me, and I can't remember exactly how many people came into Jerusalem for the Passover and stayed until Pentecost, but they had to have enough pools for all of those people who came in to take care of becoming clean. And so it's certainly understandable that if you could do it for the whole population, that 3,000 people would be not difficult at all.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Now, Josephus says that when Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70, when the Romans encircled it and basically cut it off, put up the blockade around Jerusalem, Josephus says there were 8 million people in the city. Yeah, I take that with a grain of salt. You know, he might have been trying to build up the Romans and say, well, you guys took a major city. But even if you figure that he exaggerated that by a factor of 2-4 million people, that's still a huge population of people. Of course, many of them didn't live there. They came there, like Carol was saying, for the major feasts, and Pentecost was one of those. It was the second of the great feast days, when every Jew had to come to Jerusalem, or every male Jew had to come to Jerusalem. So it's not uncommon to say that there would have been definitely more than 1 million people who had to take care of this ritual cleansing. To say that they baptized 3,000 people, it is not stretching the imagination at all. So that's why it's important we understand that they had the ability to take care of this. Just as an aside, you know, I went to the Ark Experience in Kentucky when I was back there the last time, and they have built, to the best of their ability, a wooden boat following the dimensions that are spelled out in Genesis 8. Now, they had to do a couple of things to accommodate OSHA and, you know, safety regulations. But for the most part, what they built using the tools that would have been available to Noah at that time. And the structure that they built is enormous. If you ever get a chance to go there, go. But they demonstrate that using the technology that they had at that time, they could easily have taken care of the human waste and animal waste that would have been produced on the ark. You don't have to postulate that there was a miracle, that the animals didn't make a mess. No, they made a mess and they were able to deal with it. That doesn't prove the story of the ark, but it does say that the ark is that the boat that's represented in that story is perfectly capable of doing exactly what was represented as having happened. So, you know, it's important that we understand that archaeology doesn't prove the Bible, but it does say that the Bible is not just a fanciful story that couldn't have happened. If you ever get a chance to go to the Ark Experience, I'm not shilling for the Ark Experience at all. It's a, you know, it's a commercialized theme park. They're making money off of this. But it really is an interesting trip if you get a chance to go to the Ark Experience. It's kind of out in the middle of nowhere in Kentucky, but it is worth going to. So let's think about for a minute some of the things that the rabbis talked about a mikveh had to have. Okay. And everything that we find when we find these mikvahs indicates that it had the characteristics that the rabbis talked about were so important if you were going to have a mikvah. Now, to have a mikvah isn't something that's described in the Old Testament, the characteristics of the pool where you did the washing. That isn't described in the Old Testament. The only way that we know about the characteristics of the mikvah is because the rabbis made rules about it. And so these are some of the characteristics that the rabbis talked about. First, a mikvah had to have a source of running water, a spring or fresh water like rain, if the rain would pool into a place. And that's why the rabbi said that that made it living water. In other words, you couldn't have a mechanical pump that would pump water into the pool and that be the exclusive source of water in the pool. Now you could supplement what ran in there from a spring, but you had to have a spring or you had to have rainwater. Somehow you had to have naturally occurring water that gathered in the mikvah. That's why they call it living water. And as strange as it sounds, there were people that argued back when they started to build buildings in this country that were owned by churches, and they wanted to put baptismal pools into those buildings. There were people that argued that you had to have naturally running water in the baptismal pool, couldn't be exclusively pumped in like our baptistry here. It's exclusively pumped in water. So they painted murals behind the baptismal pool that made it look like it was a pool in a woodland spring. Now that's a little bit of a silly extension of this, but you know, we sometimes go overboard trying to make sure that we have something that was like where John the Baptist baptized in the River Jordan, or something that was like where Jesus was baptized, or something that was like what the Jews had. And I think we've done a disservice when we do that. Now, second characteristic, a mikvah had to be, this is the words of the rabbis, large enough to allow an average-sized person to immerse his whole body. There is a tractate, which the Mishnah is made up of tractates. It's like books in the Mishnah. And this particular tractate, I don't even know how to pronounce that word, but it's that word, chapter 9, verse 1, requires that, and this is a quotation, for immersion to be valid, no part of the body's surface may be untouched by water. So these mikvahs were, they're big. And remember, I said before, sometimes they even baptized beds. So that's a pretty good sized mikvah. I'm sure they didn't have, you know, California king size beds, but still, that's a big pool. So they immersed the whole body. And, you know, I have to tell an embarrassing story on myself. I was baptizing a young man who was a surfer. And, you know, I tipped him over. He leaned back. Well, when he leaned back, he took a big, deep breath and he floated. So I wanted him to be immersed in the water. So I put my elbow in his chest and punched down really hard. And he suddenly exhaled. And then he sank like a rock because he was all muscle. and just about baptized me trying to stop him from sinking to the bottom of the baptistry. But it's a pretty good sized body of water. And they wanted the entire body to be immersed. Doesn't take, you know, if you curl up, you can baptize somebody in a bathtub, but that's a little bit hard. I have done it. Generally speaking, you would have stairs. Remember we talked about the mikvahs that have been found in the Qumran community where you had a low wall between different sides of the stairs. You descended on one side, you ascended on the other side. Many of the mikvahs that they found in Jerusalem aren't built that way with just a single set of stairs. They're built with a set of stairs that come, they would use it to go down on one side, and then you walk through the water and you came out on the other side. Now, sometimes they did have that low wall that separated the clean side from the unclean side, but many of the mikvahs that we found in Jerusalem just had, they basically had two sets of stairs. This is a picture of a mikvah. They were generally carved into limestone rock, and then they would be plastered with a specific kind of plaster that I don't understand. It in many ways, it reminded me, the description of it reminded me of a spa that somebody would have, an in-ground spa in their backyard. But you can see the stairs descending into the water or into the pool. And then I'm given to understand that in this one in particular, there was a corresponding set of stairs on the other side, so that you walk down one set of stairs across the area that was the pool, and then you exited on the other side. This is a mikvah that dates, they say, to the time of Jesus and the book of Acts. It's located south of the Temple Mount at the base of the double gate stairs. Many times, these mikvahs would have been located outside of the city because you couldn't enter the city if you were unclean. So they would build the mikvahs outside of the city. Interestingly, when we start talking about the buildings that we've excavated from a much earlier time period, not dating all the way back to Jesus and Jerusalem, but buildings that were built in 500, 600, up to 1,000, you find baptismal fonts or baptismal pools that were located outside of the churches. So because you couldn't enter the church if you were unclean, you had to have the pool where you could become clean, and then you could enter the church. But we'll talk about that more as we talk about these mikvahs, these baptismal pools. You learn a lot about the practice of baptism if you just look at the pool. This argues against just pouring water on someone. You wouldn't have built a mikvah like this if you just needed to have enough water to gather up some water and pour on someone. This was where you went into the water and you were completely immersed. And remember, it's not just pots and pans. These were big pools where you could immerse an entire body. If you could immerse a bed in it, for crying out loud, you could certainly immerse a person in it. Now, I realize, you know, my concept of a bed is probably not like their concept of a bed, but Jesus did say to the person, take up your bed and walk. And, you know, some people say, well, that was just a mat. It was a pretty sturdy mat. If four people could tie ropes onto the corners and you could lay in the inside of it and be let down from a roof. So it wasn't a bed like we think of as a bed, but it wasn't just a mat either.